Hello everyone, I'm Daniel and you're listening to episode number one of Spin Doctors Archive, the podcast. SpinDoctorsArchive.com is your resource for all things Spin Doctors. Set lists, discography, song and band information, news and much more. Spin Doctors drummer Aaron Comas and I had a number of conversations over the course of the past year. Our conversations revolved around the band's discography, starting from their early demo cassettes in the late 80s and leading up to their seventh studio album, which is set to be released soon. In this podcast, you can now listen to these interviews. I hope this provides you a cool way to explore or rediscover the band's music in the order it was released. Today we are starting with the Can't Say No and Piece of Glass demos, along with the band's first major release on Epic Sony, the live EP Up for Grabs. I really hope these talks bring you as much joy as they did for Aaron and me. One more thing before we start, please keep in mind that English is not my first language and I was a bit anxious while interviewing one of my musical idols, so not every question may be as profound or grammatically flawless as desired. Ready? Okay, it's time to jump into the first interview of the series. Enjoy and have a good time. We're talking about the Spin Doctors discography with the Spin Doctors' very own Aaron Comas. Aaron, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Daniel? Good to see you, man.
Doing great. Really looking forward to do this with you and to talk you through the Spin Doctors discography, the very early stuff, the most famous releases, but also the probably not so well-known releases. Let's talk about them and let's start at the beginning. The first is the only one that I don't have with me here, as I don't own it, is the Can't Say No demo. You released this in August of 1989. You recorded this in August 1989 at Green Street Studio, and it was released in November 1989. What do you remember about those sessions back in the day?
Well, that was a long time ago. Let's see, I don't remember much. No, I do remember them, though. So Can't Say No, yeah, that we put out a little cassette. We had only been a band, I guess, for about a year, maybe a little more than a year. What was the date you said we recorded it?
I think you, as far as I know, you recorded it in August of 1989 at Green Street Studios with Dave Swanson.
Yeah,
and it was mixed by Richard Vink, Dave Swanson.
Right. So yeah, those guys were called Panfish Productions, and they were hanging around New York City. They worked, you know, with Blues Traveler. I believe they were both like the Blues Traveler sound guys. They were doing their live sound, and they had a production company, and they basically we got the opportunity to go in and record, and we wanted to have something we could sell at our shows because people wanted to have something. And this was the days of cassettes. So yeah, so I remember, I'm trying to think, man, I remember Green Street Studio was a cool little studio in Soho. I think it was down like a set of, you know, basement studio. I vaguely remember. I definitely kind of remember certain things about the session. What I do remember is that, you know, we were getting either really cheap or free studio time, like after hours. I know some of it was, yeah. I think we got overdubs at like, you know, the 12 to 10 in the morning shift when like there was nobody in there. But I think we cut the basic tracks in the afternoon, if I remember. And everything, you know, there was no money and no time. And it was just like, go in and do it. And I think we recorded a lot of songs, if I remember.
Well, the one that got released, as far as I know, has six tracks. It's Jimmy, right. Olsen's Blues, Can't Say No, Hard to Exist, At This Hour, 40 or 50, and Big Fat Funky Booty. And Jimmy and Big Fat Funky Booty have horn arrangements.
Horn, yeah. So we went in there and did it. I can't remember how many songs, but I do remember we picked those songs. And we had, I remember we did like overdubs like in one night. Because I remember specifically like, you know, it was back in the days where it was just a big party and everybody was hanging out. And I remember there were like 25 people in the studio and like Eric was doing guitar overdubs and there were just like people hanging out like we were at the Nightingale or something. We probably had a gig that night and then went over after the gig, you know, because it was a total like party hanging while we were doing overdubs.
So the whole thing was basically to give the fans something to listen to at home.
Yeah. We never made a demo to try to get like a record deal or anything like that. We never even tried to get a record deal. We really just wanted to record our songs and sell them at the shows. People were always asking, how can I buy it? You have a cassette to buy, you know, whatever. we didn't. So we were like, okay, well, we need to have something to sell, you know? And
do you remember how many copies you made?
I don't. I mean, I think we probably made like 100 or 2 at first, right? And I think they sold pretty good. I'm sure we did another run of them, you know. It's kind of blurry how many we did. I remember we used a cover. There was a woman named Karen Kuhn, who's a pretty well-known photographer. Uh-huh. And she ended up coming to our shows and was a fan of the band and offered to do a photo shoot for us. And I think we used her cover art, and it was just a little cassette, you know, but it was cool. And honestly, I'll tell you, I like it a lot. And we, as you know, when we did the 20th anniversary Kryptonite, I think we put that on it, right?
Exactly.
And I'll tell you one thing about that. And yes, we did have horns on Funky Booty and
Jimmy. The other one? Jimmy Olsen's.
Didn't we have horns on Hard to Exist too?
I'm not 100% sure.
I think we might.
I was listening to it yesterday, actually, but I don't remember horns on Hard to Exist. But I'm absolutely sure about Jimmy, as I haven't heard it for quite a long time. It was like, this is unique.
But I really like that demo. Cassette, whatever you call it. I really like it a lot. I mean, I think it was. I actually prefer that one quite a bit to the next one we did up for
the Piece of Glass demo. Yeah.
Piece of Glass. I like that one, but I really just thought like. The Can't Say No demo or cassette was just, it really came out good. And to this day, some of my favorite versions, like I love Funky Booty on it. I think it's just, I think I prefer it to the version we did on Turn It Upside Down. And I definitely, out of all the versions we've done of Hard to Exist, I think the Can't Say No version, in my opinion, is the best one we've ever recorded. I just love it. I think it's just really, for me anyway, I just felt it really captured the song, the feeling of it, the sound of it is cool. It's totally different than like what ended up on the Kryptonite, which was the whole segue.
Do you remember what John Popper did on this thing? Because he is credited in the re-release.
I don't think Popper's on it. I mean, maybe he's saying background vocals or something.
Probably background, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's any harmonica on that though, right?
No, I don't think so too, but he's credited in the 20th anniversary edition.
Well, he was definitely there handing out, you know. I remember all the guys on Blues Traveler were handing out like that, you know, that I remember that epic like overdub session till like 7 in the morning where there was like literally 20 people in the control room, and definitely the Blues Traveler guys were there.
You already told us what your favorite cut of it is. It's Hard to Exist, correct?
I mean, I really like the whole thing, but I think Hard to Exist, it's one of my favorite recorded things we ever did. And I actually prefer it to the one that made the final Kryptonite record.
Fantastic. Okay, so fast forward to the next one, Piece of Glass, your second cassette. You recorded it in March 1990, so about half a year later at RPM Studios in NYC. It was engineered by Super Dave Swanson, as you wrote in the credits.
Yeah.
And it was produced by Spin Doctors, Dave Swanson, Rich Vink for Panfish Productions. There you go. And it has 8 tracks. Here it is.
Now that I see it, that I believe was actually Karen Kuhn who took that photo. I'm not sure what the first...
The other one has a Spin Doctors backdrop and you guys standing in front of it, and it's a yellowish color.
Right.
I don't have it myself, so I don't know actually.
Yeah, I can't remember. I'll look around. I may have one somewhere.
It's,
if I do,
but I can help you. It's in the liner notes of the anniversary edition. So there you go. This must be.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. That's like I think on Avenue C or Avenue B. I can't remember who took that though.
Let's take a quick break. We'll resume the interviews in a few moments. But before we delve back into the late 80s and early 90s, here's a little something related to Spin Doctors from our present decade.
They call me Chris Barron. Chris Barron is my name.
SpinDoctorsArchive.com proudly presents the best of the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour.
It's the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour.
This musical compilation features live recordings from Chris's weekly webcast series, which he presented during the peak of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021, compiled and edited by yours truly.
No, my jeans say, Daddy, Dad, I wanna go. Wanna go to Hollywood and be in the picture shows. And you said, no, I'm up.
I simply picked my favorite performances from the 2021 run of the show and created a live sampler for everyone to enjoy.
These things and others I find all in the eye of the needle.
It gets even better. Chris Barron himself gave the green light for the project and even crafted a touching and moving introduction for the collection, which is really worth reading.
Don't look down as you soar for miles, 'cause every fool who falls gets to fly for a while.
Visit our website spindoctorsarchive.com to stream or download the free compilation album The Best of the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour. I really, really recommend it.
Daniel loves the deep cuts.
Well, let's return to the 80s now and continue my discussion with Aaron. Let's talk about Piece of Glass now. 8 tracks. What Time Is It? How Could You Want Him When You Know You Could Have Me? Hungry Hermits, House, Two Princes, Refrigerator Car, Rosetta Stone, and Freeway of the Planes.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm not a big fan of that cassette.
Uh-huh.
Honestly, okay. I think everything was too fast. It just doesn't hold up to me. Like Can't Say No, like that to me, I hear that and I love it, and something about Piece of Glass, I feel like this, we, I don't know, I mean, it's not bad, but I think we ended up, like, those songs I think developed a lot from the time we did that to when a lot of them made, you know, like some of those songs ended up on Kryptonite, like Two Princes, for example. I don't like the version at all on Piece of Glass. I always felt we played that song too fast until we recorded it on Pocket for the Kryptonite, and we brought back the tempo, and I think it really, you know, sometimes you have a great song. I mean, Two Princes is a great song, you know, there's no question. But there's a lot of great songs that if they're not approached, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat with songs. Yeah. There's a lot of ways to play songs, you know, the tempo, keys, parts, the way you recorded it, the sound. There's so many things that come together for a song to really, like for a song like Two Princes to become what it became, such a big hit. There's a lot of things that have to happen. And the stars did align eventually on that. But for my money, the one we did on the Piece of Glass, it doesn't even, it's just kind of like whatever. I mean, I don't like it.
I was surprised by the tempo of the releases. It's about like 9 months later, there's another demo. I guess if you're a young band and you want to show progress in songwriting and music, what you're doing, you want to get that stuff out. But it's quite a lot of output in the very early days, right?
Well, we had so many songs. We were writing just constantly. I mean, those first couple years, I mean, we 90% of our like material, even to this day, because there's so many songs that we never put on records, you know, we were just constantly writing songs and playing them live and developing our whole sound, which is why, again, not to sound like I don't like Piece of Glass. It's not that I don't like it. I think it's cool. But I think that there was, you know, I think a lot of those particular songs hadn't really developed fully into what they became. But like, you know, we just had a big output of songwriting going on, and you know, we were playing, the band was, our following was growing, people wanted a new cassette. As an artist, you want to record stuff and just keep moving forward, and so it was obvious. And you know, like back in the old days, I mean, like when we were growing up, you remember bands would put out records every year, once a year, like record tour. These days it's like, it's just a whole different thing now.
Every 6 or 7 years, a band is doing a studio album, and mostly bands live off of touring.
So when you're like in your early 20s and you're a new band, 9 months feels like an eternity.
Yes. You know? And so you're eager to get the new stuff out and not the old stuff from last year. Yeah.
We're always very hungry to play new songs and record new songs. But again, we still were not like making these tapes to get record deals. I mean, we were... And, you know, we had people come around and offer us deals, and even Panfish Productions, you know, I remember we sat down with them. They wanted to have a meeting with us. We went to Kiev, I remember. It's a restaurant, Ukrainian restaurant in the East Village that closed. But it was a place where everybody would go after the gig. We'd go there. We'd see Blues Traveler. All these people would be handed out at like 4 a.m, you know, eating like big meal breakfast, you know, after the shows. But we had a meeting with Panfish at Kiev, and they wanted us to sign a production deal. you know, they were going to do this demo for us. And they said, that sign a deal, we'll get you a record deal. You know, we were just like, fuck that shit. We're not doing any of that. You know, we were very self-contained. We weren't about to sign anything and give anybody any sort of rights to anything. We really were just concerned with, let's make our music, let's play gigs, let's pay our bills. And that's what we did. And ultimately, I think those tapes did sort of help, because when we finally did, ultimately, when Sonnenberg approached us and it was like the record companies were coming to us, he did have these two tapes he could like play people. But in our case, it was more about coming to the concert and seeing what was going on, you know?
There's one thing I need to ask, because I see a pattern there, and it started with this release. The album or the demo is called Piece of Glass. Then we have Up for Grabs, then we have Homebelly Groove, and we have Turn It Upside Down. All song titles of yours and album titles, but all those tracks are not on the particular albums. Is there a pattern? Is this a kind of a joke that you did with the fans? Yeah, or why are you naming your records after songs that are not on it?
Well, Can't Say No was on it, right?
Yes, it started with Piece of Glass, actually.
Piece of Glass, and then, then Up for Grabs.
Yes, then Homebelly Groove.
Homebelly Groove, and then
Turn It Upside Down.
Pocket Full of Kryptonite was the line for the song. Upside Down.
Pocket Full of Kryptonite is the exception to the rule.
I think we were definitely aware of that. We were definitely, aware of that. Like, we're using titles that we like that are song titles, but not on the record. It just, I can't remember how that happened exactly, but, you know, whenever we put out a record, we usually have like a lot of titles. Often there's one title that's kind of a front runner and usually ends up making it, but there's always like a ton of titles. Everybody's got a ton of ideas. And I can't remember exactly how we ended up calling that record Piece of Glass.
Yeah, but you have no idea how weird it was for a fan on the other side of the ocean in Germany. And I was like, Homebelly Groove is a song as well. I only know it from the title.
Right.
So when I got into all the live recordings from you guys, it was like, whoa. And then I saw that pattern and I thought like, this is crazy.
So let's
go on and let's talk about the first official release with Epic Records, your first EP. It's called Up for Grabs. There is a song called Up for Grabs that you did like three times or whatever. And it's a live record recorded at Wetlands in September 1990. It was released in January of 1991, and it has seven songs, six tracks: Big Fat Funky Booty, At This Hour, Freeway, Into Lady Kerosene, Yo Mama's a Pajama, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, and Rosetta Stone. What do you remember from that night? And
what's
noteworthy about this release?
A little backstory. So we had now signed with Epic Records. So we had a record deal. So the idea was, rather than put out a full-length record, we're going to put out an EP. I guess, you know, EPs were kind of a thing sometimes, especially for maybe a young band.
They are again, right?
Yeah, they are. They are again, exactly. So we actually went in and recorded a full session at the Power Station with Frank Aversa producing first. And that's where we recorded Two Princes. And that's where we recorded Shimbo and Ali, Hard to Exist. Those three songs, we recorded a bunch of other songs too, but those were the three songs that ended up making it on Pocket Full of Kryptonite later.
Those were done at the Power Station way before the rest of the bunch from
Not Pop- way before, not way before.
Or yeah, before, before.
Before, maybe a year before.
Okay.
So we had that and that came out really great, but then we decided, you know what? We're known for being this live band. Why don't we put out a live EP instead of a studio EP? It seemed to be like I can't remember who came up with the idea, but it made total sense. I mean, it was a great idea. So we set aside that session, and which is where we had Two Princes just sitting there. And we recorded a live show at the Wetlands. So Frankie LaRocca was our A&R guy, great guy, rest his soul. And, he brought in his buddy, Peter Denenberg. They had worked together a lot on records. So Frankie's like, I know this great guy, Peter. He's an incredible engineer. So they brought in their truck. This is back in the days where you would bring in, you know, before you had like Pro Tools and portable sort of big hole, the whole truck thing pulled up to the Wetlands, all the mics. I remember I was behind my drums at soundcheck. I remember specifically Peter came up. He's like, hi, I'm Peter Denenberg. I'm going to be recording you today. You know, my first introduction to Peter.
Right.
And he was just this great guy right off the bat. You can just tell this guy's cool, you know? And so we set up, we had a great show. We did sound check And we actually recorded Rosetta Stone from the sound check, which is what we used on that record.
Chris is saying something about Roland
Quiet
tape.
In the House or something.
Quiet in the House, tape, yeah.
Quiet in the House. But that was at sound check. And that's a really great, that's one of my favorites off that record. And you can really hear the room. There's nobody in the room, so it's really extra sort of open. But that was a great thing. And funny enough, like we didn't really have a great crowd that night. Like at that point we were doing very well. We were pretty much packing out the Wetlands. But for some reason that night it was a good crowd, but it wasn't like jam packed like usually.
Okay, yeah.
It was kind of weird. It's like, oh shit, okay, we have a nice crowd here, but it's not like packed, you know. But we had a great gig, and we just sort of did our thing. I don't think we were too caught up with like we're recording, we're making a record. We're like, let's just do what we do. Don't even think about it. And then it came time to, you know, pick the songs. We picked those songs. I think it's a great record. I love it. I think it's really raw. I mean, I hear all kinds of like, you know, imperfections.
Beautiful mistakes, as you like to call them.
Beautiful
right?
mistakes. And that's exactly right. And the sound of the record is great. Peter, you know, again, it was our introduction to Peter, who was just such a great engineer. He made us sonically sound incredible. Everybody gave a great, lively performance. And I think it's great. And it was a great way to sort of have as a first release for the band.
It has like 45 minutes of running time. So, of course, it was an EP if you look at the amount of songs, but it's still worth an album's length, right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And my good friend Ludwig Schwartz did the artwork for it.
Yeah.
Ludwig's a great artist. He's the guy that I moved to New York City with from Dallas.
There you
That's
go.
It. Yeah, Ludwig Schwartz did that.
Do you remember who's that one guy at the back of the recording with a question mark on it? I'll show you the camera. Maybe you'll see it.
That's Super Dave.
That's Super Dave Swanson, right?
Yeah. So that's that's Jason over there to the left.
Jason Richards, your manager, right?
He still works with us to this day.
Until today.
And then of course there's Mark and Chris, and there's me. We got our arms around each other. I don't know what we're looking at.
Eric in the red
Dave.
T-shirt.
That's Eric on the right. And that's Super Dave. So that was just somebody took a picture. I don't know who, maybe Paul Araya took that. I'm not sure. And it was that, I think that was, I don't know, at some rehearsal or something. and everybody, I remember when we put that out, people were like, everybody thought we had like six people in the band.
Exactly, you know? Exactly, yeah.
It was just kind of a random, classic Spin Doctor do something that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you remember how the record did commercially?
I mean, not great. I mean, it came out. We didn't, you know, we weren't getting any support at all from the record company. They just sort of threw it out there. We went out on the road, I think, and we're doing some shows.
So mostly to get you some merchandise and to get something for the fans who attend your shows.
Yeah, get something out there. We got some tour support. It was the first time we had a tour bus. We went out on like a 6-week tour and played clubs around the country. And a lot of them were empty. Some of them were, you know, we were starting to get a little buzz. On the Northeast, we were doing pretty well. Yeah. You know, once we got to middle America, Colorado, we were doing well. But a lot of it was just like, I remember playing like to 5 people in Houston, this big fucking club, you know. But, you know, it was something to have out there. But it was frustrating because we weren't really getting any support. But we also knew that it was just sort of something in the interim until we put out the record.
Yes.
You know, Pocketful of Crazy.
I was impressed by how fast things went back in the day. I mean, you recorded this in September of 1990 and it was released in January of 1991. So it's like,
I mean, when you have a record company involved and it was back in the 90s, I mean, you know, it was just the industry worked much differently than it does now, you know.
Oh, yeah. Last question. I always want to know what's your favorite cut of the album. Is it Rosetta Stone?
You know, I have to go back and listen, but I'd probably say Rosetta Stone on that record. I really like everything. I mean, I hear a lot of like sort of flaws on that record, but I also really love it.
Not that it matters, but it's my favorite cut as well. I love this. I love that track.
It's got a great vibe. And I always hear that stuff and I'm like, oh, I'd probably, you know, if I'm going to play, I'd play that differently now. You know, you hear these things and you hear about how you might approach them now or what you could have done to make them better. But the vibe of that record is, I mean, I'm glad I wouldn't change a thing because it's really showcases what we were doing at the time. And I think it's very cool.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. That was chapter one. Thank you very much for talking about those first three releases of yours.
Yeah, no problem.
And with that, our initial discussion of the Spin Doctors discography comes to a close. Please join us again in the next episode as Aaron and I explore the band's most iconic record, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, as well as the Homebelly Groove Live album. My name is Daniel Heinze. Thank you for tuning in. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast. And if you enjoy this project, we would love for you to rate us 5 stars on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Also, please let other fans of Spin Doctors or other jam bands know about this project. Keep an eye on spindoctorsarchive.com for the latest 2024 set lists and news about their highly anticipated new studio album. Till we meet again, mau bi jau, people!